Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Ruler Podcast 17.2. I'm Ian Parkinson, and what a stylish edition of the podcast it is. In a minute, we'll be hearing from the man behind some of the most stylish cycling clothes around, the Savile Row tailor Timothy Everest. And after that, we'll be talking to the British road champion Hannah Barnes, who happens to ride for the team whose kit is frequently voted best in the peloton, Canyon SRAM. Ian Cleverly, Ruler editor, is with me. Plenty in the magazine this month. The workman at Paris-Roubaix caught my eye. There's a nice article from Neb Bolting about a British couple who put pro teams up in their house in Belgium. Anything else that really stands out for you?
I do actually like James Stout's piece about nutrition, which I know, and you kind of think, but it's... The guy actually kind of raced abroad for a few seasons. He knows what he's talking about. He knows that there are a myriad of ludicrous myths that abound, that pass down through generations of cyclists who then become DSs or bosses. And he just sort of rips the whole thing. But I mean, he has great fun doing it. And then actually talks to somebody who knows what they're talking about at the end. But yeah, that was a great fun piece.
Anything else?
Marshall Cabell's done a photo special of last year's Paris-Nice, which was quite extraordinary, the so-called Race to the Sun, where one day was abandoned due to snow. And obviously the day featuring snow led to the most dramatic photos. But it's a nice race anyway. And it does finally get some sun right at the end when they get down to Nice.
Interestingly, in view of current events, there's actually two articles in this edition, one by Matt Seaton, one by Robert Miller, which take us to the pretty sceptical view of the whole Team Sky and British cycling situation.
Yeah, understandably. And obviously with what's been going on in the last few days with the Parliamentary Commission, I mean, it's a never-ending smorgasbord of horrifying kind of revelations, which shows no sign of ending.
Matt Seaton very much sort of nails the myth, I suppose, that British riders don't do that, and you know the foreigners may get up to that, but the British don't.
I think so. I think that there's always been this British idea that, oh gosh, no, we don't do that sort of thing, and it's now the whole viewpoint has been very much called into question, and well, remains to be seen what we do or don't do, but the idea that just because you're British, that you're not going to cheat is
doesn't always stand up to close examination.
Doesn't always stand up to close examination.
And if you haven't read it, Robert Miller's piece towards the back of the magazine about corticosteroids, about Kenalog, etc., and its use in the peloton in the 80s, and when Robert was riding, is one of, I think, the best things I've read about the whole subject.
Yeah, well, you know, he knows what he's talking about, doesn't he? As opposed to many who don't.
So our first guest, Timothy Everest, one of Britain's most successful tailors. He did his apprenticeship with the legendary Tommy Nutter before setting up his own company. He's actually a keen cyclist, and he's collaborated on cycling kit with Rafa, Brooks, David Miller's Chapter 3, among others. In this month's magazine, there's a photo shoot at his offices at Spitalfields in London. But I went along to talk to the man himself. Timothy Everest, welcome to the Ruler podcast.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk about your clothing design and your involvement with various cycling brands a little bit later. But tell me about your own cycling. When did you actually first become a keen cyclist?
Well, I always wanted to be a racing driver, actually. I was more interested in motorsport. But I remember watching a film on NA Sunday, I think with Steve McQueen many years ago. And there's loads of sort of BMX riding and that sort of thing. Not only the motorcycling, but that side took my interest. And I was desperate to be buy a motocross, schoolboy motocross bike. And my parents wouldn't let me have one. But they said, if you go and work and earn the money, you can buy one. Anyhow, I didn't earn quite enough money. And I bought myself a Pooch racer, which at that time I remember flogging across the Kent countryside, and it seemed to be a permanent headwind or crosswind. I never really, really enjoyed it. And then I secretly bought, with a little bit of money that I earned, a little moped, and then I ended up with a schoolboy motocross. That was my intro to cycling.
And has that interest continued ever since? Have you always been a cyclist?
Yes, I have for a long time, and then I really kind of accelerated in my sort of late 20s in the start of the mountain bike scene, and I was working for a guy on Chilton Street, and these two guys turned up on these bikes called Muddy Foxes. And I said, what are they? I said, what are you riding those for? Oh, it's mountain biking. It's the really cool thing. They're all doing it in California. So I said, can I have a go on one? And I jumped onto it. This thing was really easy to ride, and it sort of went off, and that's quite cool. And then a friend of mine who'd cycled for years since he was a kid and has been a big influence on cycling, has got many, many beautiful bikes. I met around that time as well, and he was doing some work for my boss, and he was talking about, well, cycling is very cool, and sort of kind of got me into it. And cut a long story short, I ended up buying I think Kona mountain bike, which I loved, a little bit heavy but quite fun, and then doing the usual thing, going down to sort of Box Hill, Poles and Lacey, Leith Hill, all those sort of things, and doing the trails with a sort of ragtag gang of people that I knew from around here. And it became a lot of fun. And then we sort of started importing things like RockShox and Manitou forks and things from Bike Pro and Santa Rosa, kind of pre-internet. So I had to do everything through the phone and the mail. And that was quite exciting. The only problem is a sort of jaunt out in the country became very, very competitive, and it was who could get there the fastest. So then we started racing in some early bike races, which I really, really enjoyed.
And do you now mainly ride on the road, or are you still mountain biking as well?
Well, I started the business, and riding around on the mountain bike, even with Fatboy Slicks, wasn't so convenient. So I stopped cycling for about 5 years. Anyhow, I decided I'd like to start cycling again. So I got my last mountain bike out, which was an Orange with its early pace forks on it, set it up for the road, and was cycling around. And that must be about 8 years ago, 9 years ago. And then I was introduced to Luke and Simon from Rafa. And then, yeah, I had a problem with it, and I went into a bike shop locally. And I said, can I have a go on the road bike? See, there's quite a few people riding those at the moment. I'd like to have a go on one of those specialized Roubaix, and had a go on it. And again, just realised what a joy it was to ride a road bike. The geometry was not dissimilar to what I was used to on a traditional kind of mountain bike. And I started cycling again. And as we've been talking to Rafa, we had a conversation about possibly creating something clothing-wise. I got more and more into it and rekindled my interest in cycling.
I remember Simon Mottram of Rafa once saying that, when he started cycling, he looked at British cycling and its style and thought it was very monochrome and quite dull, and he wanted to bring some of the colour and the glamour of the continental scene to British cycling. What were your thoughts about the sort of the style and the clothing of cyclists in those days?
Well, it's very interesting. When we were cycling in the late 80s and early 90s, I cycled with a guy called Jerry Aaron, who went on to set up Mud Dog. And he almost described what Rafa would be. And that's was kind of his vision. And it was actually quite monochromatic. No one's doing sort of dangerous sort of black clothing and all these things. So when we were sort of hiking up a hill or whatever, we'd have these long conversations about what clothing could you have. Because at that time, there were lots of brands. I mean, there was Castelli, and I've actually got some stuff from there. It's quite wild. And I think Alpine Stars and people like that were doing stuff for mountain biking. But if you came herring around a corner in this sort of fluoro stuff, you'd scare someone straight off their horse or whatever. But no one was actually looking at what you could actually wear in those conditions and maybe go to the pub or have a meeting or whatever. So we kind of talked about it many, many years before. I think what happens when I got back into cycling, I discovered clothing through Rafa, which I found was actually very wearable, very, very cool, very simple. And on that early journey of where they were going was very interesting. And then, of course, then I started to read up about things and we started to start to explore about the possibilities. And one of the things I liked about British cycling was, I think there was a thing called the Stealth Series many years ago, where the cycling was so popular and people were having their own sort of made-up races that the police were on the lookout for them. So people were actually wearing civvies, you know, like a jacket and trousers probably rolled up on the right leg and still racing so that they could try and tell the law that they weren't, or, you know, the Rozzers, that they weren't actually racing.
It was certainly the first involvement with Rafa of yours that I was aware of, I think, was the bespoke cycling suit. Can you remind us about that?
Yeah, I mean, we can't remember how we actually met, but they ended up coming here to Elder Street, where we're sitting today, our lovely Georgian house in Spitalfields. And they were saying, well, what could we, you know, what could you cycle in that you could actually go to a meeting or, you know, go out for lunch or something? And I think at that time, they were kind of feeling their way where the handwriting, the brand was going. So the jacket we did was probably, although it had a nanotechnology, it was very practical, it had a nod to a more of the heritage of a jacket. Whereas I think after we'd been working on it, and someone was very always interested to have conversations, I always felt that their hub probably was looking at kind of contemporary and clean and modern, and that was probably their kind of handwriting. We talked a lot about early 80s kind of designers like Izzy Miyake and Yoji Yamamoto about how they looked at sort of traditional clothing in a more contemporary way. And maybe the jacket we were doing needed to morph into something a little bit more technical and more simple. But that's how we started. Well, it was very successful. We had a sell out of 100%, and it was a really good intro to our next venture, which was Brooks England.
Yeah, how did that come about? Because you ended up working with the sort of Brooks offshoot, John Boltby.
And the problem they had is they couldn't use Brooks on clothing, in the sense that Brooks America owned the rights to that. So we came up with the idea of John Boltby, the founder of Brooks, and created the idea of the John Boltby collection. I wanted to sort of make a statement with sort of the ultimate kind of garment, that I thought that someone should be looking at cycling where possibly you would go cycling in it, but you could use this garment in everyday wear. You know, having been interested in motorbikes, and I still have a Bellstaff Trials Master, you know, and Barber obviously now making things that you can actually wear on a motorbike and on bicycles, so the collaboration they did with the Japanese gentleman. I thought it was important that we made this kind of all singing and dancing garment that was a kind of benchmark for a more democratic product to come.
It's a really sort of compelling idea, that idea that you can dress well for the bike and for the office or for wherever, or for a night out. It's really hard to pull off, though, isn't it? And you look around, particularly sort of, you know, London cyclists, it doesn't seem to have caught on necessarily.
Not in London, because it still is the computer Grand Prix, or commuter Grand Prix, I should say. The mammals still are racing to and from work. I come in from Kingston Hill, so it's about 12 and a half, 13 miles. So it's difficult not to wear something that doesn't have a little bit of give, is, you know, suitable for our inclement or temperate isle type of weather. So it is a compromise. And I think what is interesting, actually talking to David when he was bought a Brompton, and then he suddenly realised it's actually not about racing everywhere, it's actually the journey. Then you start to think about what you could wear in that journey. And we had a meeting a few weeks ago, and he turned up in his Brompton, checked it into Little House, Soho House in Berkeley Square, or just off there, Curzon Street, and sitting there not in a sweat. And he said it was a real treat not to have to race somewhere. And he said, I thought about it. All these guys went piling past me in their Lycra, and they're probably showering as in the office now, having got up and left earlier than me. And we were having a meeting and a nice cup of coffee and some poached eggs on toast. And that's kind of interesting, as to, I think we'll start to get that you don't actually have to race everywhere. And then the clothing can come together. I still think someone hasn't yet captured the idea, I know it's a pun, the hub of cycling, that no one's really doing a proper collection that you could be cycling in that's not following the peloton. A lot of them are still looking at a technical angle. There's an argument with someone I'm having at the moment, which is not their personal style, it's their previous style. And they want everything to be super technical. But we did an awful lot of research when we were doing Brooks. It was very interesting when I think Outlier as a brand was taking off, is that when we spoke to people on forums, a lot of people who were going to wear practical clothing didn't necessarily need to have, to roll up the leg with a special strap or to have something overly reflective or whatever. They wanted something that was actually comfortable, that possibly was showerproof, maybe does have, take that back, a touch reflective, but they just said you can roll the leg up. You don't have to do any more than that. And that's very, very interesting. You want things that are still elegant but practical.
Do you think they do it better in Europe?
I think they do because they're used to commuting. I mean, I was in Florence recently. If you go around there, people go from A to B, and they use a bike conveniently, Amsterdam, Berlin, so on. And I think they're more used to it. I think we are quite unique in the way that we commute.
You mentioned David there, David Miller, and that's sort of, I guess, one of your latest collaborations, isn't it? Because you've been very much involved in David Miller's Chapter 3 clothing.
Well, it's very much him and Richard, and at the moment it's a collaboration with Castelli, which is going very, very well. And I think it's a nice alternative to Rafa. I think that's the good thing. There's room for other brands. I think there are people who buy both brands and other brands as well. And I think there's niches within niches. So Castelli seems to have got off to quite a good start. And we helped, particularly with Richard, talking through what that journey could be. They've developed with that, and we've worked with the Gabber and other things, getting sort of the fit and detailing right on that. The idea that, you know, a gentleman would have the colour on the inside, not on the outside, was quite important. You know, as you said, he's been basically a billboard all his life. He wants to actually be not invisible, but basically be more subtle. So that's why the whole sort of, you know, the base layers are really, really bright and those things, rather than the outside, although they're adding colour. And then more recently, they're doing a project with Brompton. And we've done a Brompton Chapter 3 cycling jacket, which is based on a jacket that we did for David for the Brompton races around the Mall. And he said, what should we do? And I said, I don't know, what do you think? And we had a chat about it. And Mike Hailwood sprung to mind. And I think Nigel Caborn some years ago did a tribute to him. But also they used to wear some kind of Harrington, which then they would wear the bottoms, which is like a split overalls. And we thought it'd be quite funny. And then David pinged me an image of Mike Hailwood wearing it with a bow tie. He said, you know, I've got to wear some kind of tie. And I said, well, why don't we do a bow tie and that? And we'll pimp it up a bit. And then the next thing, we were trading images. And I think he sent one of the Bonneville time trials. You know, and there's someone on an old Indian with a sort of big Indian logo on the back. So I sent him a sort of rendering where we'd drawn up something on the computer, which was ice blue, sort of Ventile. From our factory that we work up in North London.
One of the challenges, it always strikes me, for making cycling clothing, especially for, you know, not for professionals, must be that it's actually quite hard to make men look attractive or stylish in Lycra in particular, isn't it? Unless you are built like David Miller, or even perhaps, I don't know, Mario Cipollini or someone. It doesn't flatter the average male figure.
No, it doesn't, unfortunately, and that's the problem. This is probably one of the debates I've been having with somebody, that some kind of a jacket always kind of does work. It's just about the right kind of sort of fit and so on. Some kind of Mac works, and it certain things work, and there's a reason why they work. It's about, I think, exploring those that then are very practical. And Lycra's fine, and it's perfect. If you are doing, you know, going out for a serious ride and whatever, you can't really beat some of those sort of those things. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to be very comfortable. But I think that's what's starting to happen, is that once people get into cycling, I as I said, started in mountain biking, then I've discovered road biking. I'm now doing a bit of mountain biking. I really want to get into cyclocross. I'm kind of find that's rather appealing. My wife pointed out we've got 14 bicycles at home, which is ridiculous. But both my daughters cycle as well, they can take two of those bikes. But is that we're now realizing that bikes are, you know, different bikes for different occasions. Well, why wouldn't you have your wardrobe like that?
So what's your next big project, sort of cycling related?
Well, hopefully we can develop the après side, as we've called it, with David. His brief was, what do I wear on the sofa with my kids in Girona and take Mrs. out for a posh tapas supper? I was at a hotel recently and, you know, I'm pretty casually dressed these days. I still wear a tie, not that often. But I was at a hotel and I was try to be casual but elegant. And I was surprised by a lot of people who looked, and this is, I don't want to be judgmental, but because I think there's still confusion in the menswear market. People look like they just got off the sofa having watched Gogglebox or something, because that's how they're very, it's fine, and that's what you want to do. But what happens when you see someone who walks in who's casual but elegant, you can see these people feeling uncomfortable. And they either think, oh, well, I wish it was like that, or they have to make a comment because they feel inadequate. I think that there's confusion in clothing, not just in cycling world.
The Savile Row tailor, Timothy Everest. Hannah Barnes is one of the UK's most successful cyclists at the moment, national road champion, second in the World Time Trial Championships last year, riding for the World Tour team Canyon-SRAM. And she joins us on the line now. Hannah, where are you?
Right now I'm in Girona in Spain.
And is that where you're based for most of the season?
Yeah, this is home for me from now on, really. Been the last 2 years I've spent here, and then, yeah, this is pretty much where I spend all my time.
It's extraordinary how Girona has sort of become the absolute go-to place for pro cyclists.
It's been pretty noticeable this winter, especially how many cyclists have been here, especially Brits. There's been a lot of British riders here. This is my third winter here. The first winter that I was here, there was a handful of us, really. Very, very few. And now it's kind of, you can't walk into the coffee shop or the meeting point, let's say at 10:30, without seeing so many, many riders. It's been pretty amazing, actually.
Is that a good thing? Or do you sometimes just want to sort of get out of the pro cycling bubble a bit?
Depends, really. Sometimes it was pretty overwhelming how many people were here. I mean, you couldn't go out to dinner without seeing people out. And for me, it's kind of, when you live somewhere, you don't want to be constantly reminded of, I don't know, cycling, really. You want to go out for dinner and just be you, really. But then if you want to go for a group ride, there's always someone to go with, which is quite nice, especially if you have a long training ride. There's a really good community of women cyclists here now as well, which has been really, really nice, and I've enjoyed having them, and just being at a race is with someone that you spend a lot of time with anyway is quite nice. Sometimes I've been like, oh, there's too many people here, but most of the time it's been really nice.
And pretty good roads around the city to ride.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that so many people live here. You ride around and you can do 3 hours or 4 hours but feeling like you've just done an hour riding, it just makes the time go so much faster.
And conveniently, Ian, there's actually a Girona City Guide on our website that's just gone up in the last couple of weeks. So if anybody's thinking of going over, tells you where to go and how to do it.
So Hannah, how's the season going so far?
Yeah, it's been really good. I mean, it's in Belgium, typical Belgian weather and terrain. I mean, didn't come into last season how I'd like to, so now I've actually got the form that I wanted, and I've trained really, really hard this winter, and I feel that my performances in the last two races I'm really happy with, and yeah, it's just kind of nice to have that confidence going into the next block of racing.
I didn't see Le Samin, Hannah, but I did watch some of Hageland, and you were looking strong there and had a nice break working, but it didn't pan out.
It went up a cobble climb, a really hard climb, and I was at the front when that break went, and it was a really good strong break, but unfortunately it was just too far from the line for everyone to be committed in it. And a few teams missed it as well, so they brought it back. But I mean, I was given midway through the race, the role of team leader, and that's a position that I've not yet experienced in those kind of European races. It was quite nerve-wracking being that leader, and I definitely have a lot of work to do to improve in being in that role. But it was a really great experience to be there, and can just use that momentum and motivation to keep going.
Canyon-SRAM are a really strong team, which is a great thing, but also I guess quite a challenge if you're fighting for a place on it.
Yeah, I mean, there's 11 riders on the team now, and yeah, we've got a lot of strong riders. So those races that you really want to do, you kind of have to fight your teammates to do them. But yeah, the team are really good at picking riders that suit those races really well, and we can go into every race as a team that can win the race. So I think we just have to always focus on that and know that the team that's gone to that race is the one that's best suited for that.
You've got Pauline Ferrand-Prévot on the team this year, who's, you know, she has the potential to get some good results for you, I guess.
She hasn't raced since the Olympics, and we were on team camp, and she fitted in really, really well with the team. Must have been really daunting because we had 9 riders on the team. So it was Pauline coming into the team as the only new rider, only changed the team. And then we had the Zwift rider, Leah, join the team after that. But yeah, for her to come into a team, and she just joined it so well. There was no moments where she didn't feel part of the team, or we didn't feel like she wanted to be in the team. She was really happy there. And I think that's going to be really, really good for her this year to use that as kind of fuel for the fire.
Tell us some more about the Zwift rider, Leah, because a lot of people may not be familiar with her story, and it is a fascinating story.
Yeah, so the Zwift Academy, if no one's heard of it, we had 1,200 women riders sign up for that. They all had to do power tests and things, and whoever had the highest power and the best power and power to weight, I think it went off the most, would come down to 10 riders, and then they'd do more tests, and then we had 3 final riders would come on our training camp in December in Mallorca. That was the selection camp, I guess, who fitted into the team well, who seemed the most motivated, who liked it the most, and who was the strongest. And Leah hit all of those, really.
Leah's a distance runner, isn't she, who's converted to cycling. So am I right in thinking Hageland was her first race?
It was quite a shock. She was really nervous but going into it. It's just a massive step for her. I mean, she did long distance running, got a lot of injuries, and used riding as kind of the way to get better and do rehab, and then she just loved doing it like that. But yeah, she struggled with Hageland. It's such a hard race. It's narrow roads, typical Belgium racing. She finished the race, she was about 3.5-4 minutes down from the winner, which I couldn't believe. I punctured, I think, with 35k to go in the race, and I came past her, and I was amazed that she was still in contention with her in the race, still part of it. And it was really great to see her progression over those 2 races. And I think, she proved that you can be strong and just train on the trainer, but then you can come into a race like that. And I mean, she was getting the hang of it.
How do you think women's racing and the World Tour is looking this year? We've got, domestically, we've got a expanded Women's Tour of Britain, but also I think yesterday or the day before, it looks like we've lost La Route de France.
I think we were actually saying, driving to the airport on Wednesday, that this year is going to be really great. We've got, last year Bowls were really dominant in the results, but this year we've got so many teams that have so many strong riders. We as a whole, we need to really focus on the present and the future and just making this sport move forward. And I think it is, and it's such a good time to be a female cyclist right now.
Obviously, you don't know your exact schedule, but is there a race you're really looking forward to this season?
There's a few. I mean, the one days like Amstel and Liège, I think, are really a great addition to our calendar. So I'm looking forward to those. And then obviously everyone loves the Women's Tour in June in Britain. I love going there because it makes you so proud to be British. It's quite amazing racing through those villages and towns with all the school children on the side of the road and just all those fans. It's really amazing. And then going into the nationals as well, in the Isle of Man, it's going to be a really good race.
And that's going to be a hard race as well, isn't it? It's a hard circuit.
Yeah, it's everyone saying, we don't know the course yet, but it doesn't matter. You know it's going to be hard whatever. So my dad's coming out for the week as my helper, so that's going to be really good.
We were saying earlier on that to the Canyon-SRAM team kit is one of the most sort of admired in the peloton. Everyone likes the design, but of course you haven't actually been wearing it much of the time, have you, because you get to wear the boring old white one with the red and blue stripes.
No, it's the national one is so good. I love it. Everyone, it's crazy the amount of comments I get on it. That I think what makes it so great is just how minimalistic it is. It's just how it was. It's just this the 3 stripes with 3 sponsor logos on it, and I think that's what makes it so special. Everyone's like, but it's white when it's rain, and like in the spring classics, of course it's gonna get dirty, but we have that training kit that's just like the original kit, but the, I've got the blue and red of the kit on it, which I think it looks so smart and just means you're not going to wreck that white, the white kit in when you're training in the rain.
I don't know if the listeners at home could hear, there was a noise in the background earlier when we started the interview. That was actually Hannah's washing machine struggling to get the white kit clean, apparently, allegedly. New bearings required.
Yeah, it will get fixed soon. It's just, I actually turned it on and then went to bed for a little nap, so I didn't hear it.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Before you go, have you had a chance to look through the magazine and choose a favourite picture?
Yeah, it's the Canyon SRAM, the Canyon advert.
Hannah, that's an advert. You're supposed to choose our beautiful photographer's work, not adverts.
But it is a beautiful picture.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're not choosing that just because it's a canyon by any chance, are you?
No, not at all.
We'll let you off with that one, Hannah. We'll let you off with that one. Good work on behalf of the sponsors. Ian, anything that stood out for you?
I've gone for fairly personal reasons, I guess, in some respects, is on page 83, it's a rather beautiful-looking Belgian house that belongs to former British champion Tim Harris, where hundreds of cycling stars, or not necessarily, because not cycling stars when they first stayed there, but, you know, people who eventually become stars, have stayed over the years. And I've been to that house myself. And it's just a photo of this, the front of the house with them, with Tim sat there on the doorstep. Tim and his partner Joss run it between them, and they do a lot of work for the Dave Rayner Fund as well. And you'll see them on the races. They're always at the Tour and at the Tour of Britain. Yeah, everybody knows Tim and Joss, don't they, Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, I saw them on Sunday. You know, you're riding to the sign on, and they're there supporting you. And yeah, it's I was supported by them in 2012 and 2013, I think. Oh no, 2014. So yeah, they're a really great couple. That, I mean, they've helped so many riders out get to where they are, really. And if it wasn't for their fund, I mean, pretty sure I wouldn't be here now. It's I spent 2012 in Holland, and I would rely on that funding to buy food and drinks and a ferry crossing home to see the family. So I know how important it is.
I mean, it's not like it's a massive amount of money, is it? But it's enough for you to get by, so that you don't have to kind of worry about the absolute basics, and you can focus on your racing.
Yeah, definitely.
If Hannah is allowed to choose an advert, can I choose a cover? It's the cover of the subscribers edition, not the one that you can buy in WH Smith. It's a really striking image and such an amazing colour. It's Marshall Capel's shot of the blue safety zone, the Côte d'Azur on the Roubaix Velodrome. And it's just such a lovely picture and such a lovely colour. Really, really stands out. So I'm going to have that one.
And it's not because you're a trackie at that.
It's not because I'm a trackie, and the mere sight of the Côte d'Azur brings me out in palpitations. No, it's not. So all that remains is the quiz. On 17.1, what was the question we asked?
We asked, at the 2006 Paris-Roubaix, fifth place Tom Boonen was promoted second behind Fabian Cancellara. The other three riders in between were disqualified by the race jury. Why?
I remember the question now, but I don't know the answer.
You don't? The level crossing came down, and these three riders went through it. Leif Hoste, Peter van Petegem, and Vladimir Gusev.
Now I remember. And who's the winner?
The winner is Barry Tolland from Galway. Lovely Galway.
And what are we asking for 17.2?
We are asking, in reference to Tim Harris's house in Belgium that I was talking about just a few minutes ago, there's this quote in the piece. You have to try and work out who the rider we're talking about is. Okay? Here we go. The house has produced a number of British road champions, including, who prepared for his victory by sitting up till 3 o'clock in the morning, smoking cigars, drinking brandy, and eating Spanish ham with Adam Blythe.
I think we could probably guess the answer to that. Hannah, you're not allowed to.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. It was a few years back. The prize For those who wish to enter, and is a rather lovely sort of grey ruler sweatshirt that we started doing recently, which have been going down well. And you can enter via the website on the podcast page on the website.
Okay, that's it for Ruler Podcast 17.2. Thanks to Ian Cleverly, thanks to Timothy Everest, and thank you in Girona to Hannah Barnes. Thanks for joining us and good luck for the rest of the season.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition. Stay safe out there. We'll talk next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.